And once she started the recording, if Marika could carry out the roll call, please.
I think Gisela will do that.
Okay, Gisela.
Excuse me, the recordings have started.
Thank you.
Thanks. I'll do a quick roll call for you, Michaelis. Gisela, good morning, good afternoon to everyone. On today's call, we have Michaela Nalon, Kevin Erdman, Barbara Steele, Paul Diaz, Tim Ruiz, James Bladell, Chris Chaplow, Eric Brown. From staff, we have Marika Konings, Glenn de Saint-Géry, David Gieser, Olaf Nordling, and myself, Gisela Gruber-White. We have apologies from Barry Cobb and Anil George. If I could also just remind everyone, please to state their names for transcript purposes. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks everybody. Good afternoon. It's Michaela here. Just looking at the agenda we have for today, we've done the roll call now. The next item on the agenda was the meeting in Seoul and what the agenda of that should be. So, does anybody have any thoughts on that? No?
This is Marika.
Oh, sorry, there's hands up. Yes, go ahead, Marika.
One suggestion I would have, looking at the public comments received and some of the discussions we had on previous calls, is that there seems to be a desire to possibly review the TDRP to see whether there could be any changes made to that to address Charter Question 1 on the urgent return of a hijacked domain name. So an option would be to maybe have someone that is an expert in the TDRP provide an update or overview of that process to the group, because at least I know myself, I'm definitely not an expert in that area, and there might be others that would benefit from a detailed overview of that, and I might help the group as well to identify what, if anything, could be changed or adapted to adjust for such a quicker process for resolving disputes.
So what's the TDRP? I keep getting confused with acronyms already.
TDRP? Transfer Dispute Resolution Process.
Okay, can we just... Okay, so the dispute of the dispute resolution. Okay, thanks. James?
Sorry, a little slow on the mute button. To your question regarding any items for the agenda, I guess my question is, have we decided on the format for this meeting? This is an open meeting with folks that are not necessarily participating on this group. So, what type of topics are on the table for that meeting, and do we want to, solicit topics kind of on the fly from the folks who show up there?
Good question. Well, if we're looking at Marika's suggestion of some kind of overview of the existing policies and just a kind of an explanation, that might help. But the one thing I would personally be afraid of is if we have a far too open meeting, that we end up with people raising lots of issues that are way out of scope. I don't know what anybody else thinks about that. Marika, your hands up again.
This is Marika again. If I can maybe just raise as an example what some of the other working groups do. For example, the Registration of Views Group, how they run their open meeting is that they have a one-hour meeting of the working group that is open for others to attend, but it's, in principle, only open for working group members to intervene and discuss. So it's, like we have now our regular call, that's just, progressing on the issues and the topics we're discussing. And then the last half of the meeting is then open for others to ask questions or provide input on the discussions that were had in the first hour. So to have a bit that distinction and coordinate a bit of what issues are being raised and how the meeting is run. So that might be something for the group to consider.
How well does that work in reality, Marika? Do you end up in a kind of situation where two or three people end up dominating the entire thing, or is it something where, you actually do get a reasonable amount of participation without there being fights?
I think it works okay. The only thing is, of course, that it needs to be communicated well to those in the room, and the challenge is a little bit, if people are joining late, they might not realize that they're not expected to speak or intervene in the meantime. So that's something that, you know, needs to be managed or communicated well. Of course, you know, on certain issues, you'll still have, you know, some strong voices, but I guess there's as well for the chair at some point to say, well, you know, we've really covered that issue and let's move on. You know, as this meeting is taking place very early and it's, you know, a very specific particular issue, I'm not really sure how much, how many participants outside of those that are in the group will attend. So, you know, I'm not sure how it will go, but I think it's manageable as long as we communicate well how the meeting is being run and when people have an opportunity to intervene or make their questions, or as well be able to direct them if, you know, the question is not related to what we're discussing, to say, well, this is actually not for this group to discuss now, but we're happy to take it back, you know, in some other forum and, you know, discuss it there if appropriate.
Okay. Well, that's fair enough. I mean, if it's going to be early in the morning, which it is, then, I mean, I presume I'm meant to be chairing that meeting, am I, or as the chair of the group? So, I mean, I'll be expecting loads of coffee to be poured down my throat before I can manage sentient conversation. Any other thoughts on the meeting in Seoul? Does anybody have any objections to what Mariko was suggesting? No hands up? Nothing?
Well, this is Mariko, and if there's no objection to that, of course, the next question would be, who would be that person that will be able to provide such an overview? And, you know, having quickly looked at the policy, I understand that it's often the registry provider that's involved. So looking at Barbara, I don't know if she or if she would be able to identify someone that will be able to, you know, provide such an overview and maybe have as well some ideas of which areas might be suitable for, you know, reducing the overall timeline. And so.
Barbara, any thoughts?
I'm sorry, I missed part of that.
Go ahead, Marika.
I can repeat. So the idea would be to maybe have a more detailed discussion on the TDRP in relation to Charter Question 1. But as it's relatively new territory, I guess, for many, the idea would be to have someone maybe provide an overview of how the TDRP works in practice, as it might help the group to identify which parts might be suitable for modification or changes. So as I noticed from the policy or that the registry provider is one of the dispute resolution providers available to registrars, would you be able to identify someone that might be able to give such an overview?
As far as availability is concerned, I'm not sure that I would be available to do that. But so are you looking to do this at the open meeting in Seoul? Or
yes.
In general, yeah, I'm not going to be able to do that. Eric, are you available in Seoul to do that? I mean, I have a pretty good, like a timeline depiction of, you know, what happens when that I can provide, but I'm not going to be available for that particular meeting.
Yeah, I'll be in Seoul. I can probably do that. If not myself, I can probably get Jeff or someone to step in if it's more legal-oriented, but... one of us.
Okay, and in the interim, I can go ahead and send out, you know, what I have as far as the timeline is, you know, from the submission through, you know, the entire process. Would that work? Or be helpful?
Sure, I think so.
Okay.
And what I will do in the meantime, I'll try to see if I can update the schedule so those that are interested in the meeting know as well, you know, that one of the issues that will be discussed is the TDRP, so it might be an opportunity as well for others to learn more about that.
Okay. Okay. Any other input on the meeting in Seoul? Okay, moving on. The public comment period. Marika sent round a summary of the comments that have been received. Did you all get a chance to have a look over that? Any input there?
Everybody must be reading them right now. It's so quiet.
Are we all running off to read them really, really quickly, and pretending that we had read them in advance?
We are.
Thank you for your honesty, whoever that was. It's okay.
This is Paul. I'm trying to get through them. Tim caught me. I was trying to read them now, but you know, in fairness, this was just sent out, at least according to my clock, at barely 7 a.m. this morning, my time. So it's kind of difficult to get through this much in a few hours.
Excuses. Yeah. I'm so disappointed.
Yeah,
right.
That's my fault. I'm sorry for the late notice, but I was hoping that maybe people would have reviewed the complete comments already.
The summaries are kind of neat, at least for me anyway. Thanks, Marika. Okay, just looking at the text here that Marika sent around, I'm going to go through it a bit just to save on those of you who are trying to speed read. Summary analysis. Three submissions were related to issues that were deemed not to be relevant to the charter questions. Who is accuracy, privacy, and a complaint relating to a specific registrar. The other contributors provided input on the different charter questions or other related issues for consideration. So, who were the people who submitted comments? Okay, we have Bob Ross, Charles Christopher, Patrick Mevsek, Peter Van, I can't pronounce that properly, so I'm not going to try, the registrar constituency in WIPO, and I think, Marika, you said you'd received another comment from somebody else, was that correct?
Yeah, this is Marika again. Just a note, I did receive an email as well that the IPC has submitted their constituency statement, but I think they've submitted that directly to the secretariat. In these comments, the registrar constituency did submit their comments as well as part of the public comment period. So something similar happened in another working group, and there was decided that they, you know, for each of those comments, they decided to review the constituency statements all together and public comments together. I mean, of course, here we have less public comments to deal with, so the group might decide to take everything together in one review, although, of course, we haven't received all the others yet.
Right. Well,
Tim.
Go ahead, Tim.
Well, I was just wondering which constituencies do we have statements from or comments from?
So far, only the registrar constituency statements. I've seen that so far. I received a notice from Anil that the IPC has submitted something as well, and I presume that was sent to the GNSO secretariat. So I'm going to check with Glenn if she has received that. Others have not submitted yet, but the deadline is 16.
I think that I've seen the IPC comments, Marika.
If you can post that then to the mailing list, Glenn, that would be helpful.
No, I don't think I've
seen
that.
Oh, you haven't?
No.
Let me then go back to them and see where they are.
Did you get
it? It might be that it's submitted to the public comment forum, but I think that has been closed, or, you know, it's... I'm not sure whether we're still accepting comments there because the forum has been, you know, the deadline has passed. So I will go back to them to see where they've submitted it.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks. Okay, with the public comments that we do have, we realize that people haven't had a chance to read over them all. There weren't that many comments. Do people want to go over them now, or do you want to have time to read them in and come back to them again in the future, or what way do you want to deal with them?
Michele, this is Marika again, because another question for the group would be is how they would like to review the comments, or how they would... I mean, some of the other groups who've developed the grid and trying to address each of the comments or each of the element of the comments separately, and because as well as part of the effort of, you know, being more thorough and consistent about comments being received and how they are being considered by working groups and how they're being taken into consideration and why they haven't been taken into account. I think it's, you know, going to be more important going forward as well. I think in the light of the new the affirmation document, which talks as well about the importance of respecting public comments. So it's something for the group as well to consider how they would like to go about that in reviewing and addressing those.
Okay, thank you. Does anybody have any thoughts or input on this? You're all very, very quiet today. kind of worrying. Tim?
Well, I think, I just a suggestion, but, you know, just kind of shooting from the hip a little bit, I guess, would be, in some of the summaries that I've seen that I've liked are the ones that, whether they identify who the comments come from or not, but look at the substance of the comments and group them where they're similar, so that we just have basically a list of these are the comments, the summary of the comments that were made on various issues, without repeating, combining them so that we just have an issue list, so that we can look at each one and be able to compile a response to the issues. And it may not necessarily be a response to individual commenters, because that could sometimes get out of hand, but it would be a comment to each of the issues that were raised. And, maybe in some cases it might be that it's not within this group's charter to deal with or whatever, but that kind of issues list, I think, that I've seen before, that I kind of like that.
Is that a bit like the way it's been done in the post-expiry group, Tim? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, yeah.
That kind of grid type thing. Does anybody else have any comments or thoughts?
Chris here. Yeah.
James has a hand up.
Oh, thanks, McKelly. This is James, and I just wanted to agree with what Tim was saying there at the end. I like the I prefer the method where comments are mapped to charter questions. Even if a single comment touches on, say, multiple areas of the charter, that they're mapped to that, we use that to kind of inform the discussions of those various charter questions. And if they don't map to a charter question, then we note that as well.
And for those of you who are not logged in to the Adobe Connect, Paul Diaz agreed with that comment from Tim and James. Barbara, do you have any thoughts? David, Eric, anybody?
No, I don't.
This is David. I'm good with the approach.
Okay. So the kind of grid type thing we agree would be a good approach to take?
Chris here, yes. Yeah, to do it with when we discuss the different issues, one of which we've sort of discussed now, haven't we, and four we've still got to do.
Okay. Any other thoughts? Okay, so, Marika, that grid-type thing that you were doing with that other working group seemed to be a popular option. If we could use that, that would probably help.
Okay, I will develop a similar one for this for these comments received here.
Okay, perfect. Right. Okay, so maybe we might come back to that at the next meeting.
Is that something? This is Tim. Just a question, based on being reasonable about the fact that SOLA's coming up, and that. I mean, is that something Marika can get done before?
Okay, that's a good question as well. Sorry, Tim, you're perfectly right. Marika, I mean, are you under pressure at the moment, time wise?
Always under pressure, but as this is a relatively low number of public comments, I think it will be feasible to get that ready by the Seoul meeting.
Okay, thank you. Right, okay, just move on. Yes, sorry, Tim.
Nope, it wasn't me.
I didn't quite catch that.
That wasn't me, McKaylee.
Oh, sorry. Thought it was. Beg your pardon. Does anybody else want to jump in here? No. Okay. Okay, so we'll move. So Marika's going to do some work on that just to make the review of the comments that little bit saner. The next item we had on the agenda was to wrap up our initial discussion on issue A, which is whether a process for urgent return / resolution of a domain name should be developed as discussed within the SSAC hijacking report. So does anybody have anything further to say on that at this time? Okay. Marika, and then Paul.
Yeah, just Marika, just to mention that, you know, if we're having the discussion on a TDRP in Seoul, we'll have a chance to discuss that in further detail as well at that point.
True. Paul?
She beat me to it.
Okay, fair enough. James?
Yeah, Michele, perhaps if you could, if you or Marika could give us a one-sentence summary of where we left that discussion. I think I've jumped into this cold and just came off of another call, so I'm not sure I really want to say that I'm fine with where we left it when I can't really recall how we ended our previous conversation on issue A.
From what I recall, and I'm sure Marika will correct me, a lot of the issues were sorted out between the registrars before going to the registries, and from what I recall, I think Barbara may have said something about gone through the number of times that complaints actually may land on her desk, and the number was very, very low. That's just from my own personal memory.
That's correct.
Yes, and so we were looking at something. For example, as a mechanism for an urgent return, we were looking at something that would be an escalation if that inter-registrar cooperation were to fail. So this would be a means to escalate to the registry. Am I remembering that correctly, or?
That sounds right to me. I don't know if anybody else has any thoughts on that. Marika, you've got a very good memory.
Maybe not a good memory, but I'm just looking at my notes from that call, because some of the other things we discussed were... that it should be as well, you know, we should have criteria that are objectively determinable, and I think that's where we spend some time discussing in these cases, can you have any criteria that would really be objective and allow for a quick return, or, you know, what is the burden of proof, how much time would you need to spend to actually prove that it was a hijacking and it should be returned. Then there were questions as well, like, in case if you go indeed in looking at a separate procedure, what will be the default status? Would you return to the original status, or would you freeze the status that it's in until you've resolved the dispute? It's already discussed as well some elements. And as well, the question arose there as well, like, how does the TDRP fit in there? And should the group review whether there's a way to actually speed up the TDRP or see whether a separate process could be developed within the TDRP that would address this specific issue.
Okay.
And then there was, I'm sorry, this is James speaking again, and then there was another question, if I recall, and perhaps this is more of a question that was maybe meant to bring up and didn't get a chance to address it, but the question of whether this process would be an optional mechanism for registrars, or it would be a required or mandated process that they would have to provide at the registrant's request, meaning that the registrant could say, you know, I agree with you that you and Paul Diaz can work this out, or I don't trust that you guys are going to work this out in my advantage. I'm going to compel you to use this particular process as opposed to allowing you to use your existing communication channels. And I think that we touched on that a little bit, or if we didn't, we should have.
And this is Rick. I guess that will go back at some point as well if we will be looking at the TDRP on, you know, whether registrants should be able to initiate or not. I guess that's closely linked as well to that question.
I think some, from my recall now, that James has reminded me as well, I think some of the problems we were looking at was if we put too much in there, that it would actually break things badly. I think if you'd end up with, if it would be overly policied, as it were, might be too much policy. If that's my recollection. Paul has his hand up.
Thanks, Michele. I just wanted to make sure, for the record, we're all in agreement, even though we're saying we're moving on. These are just our initial discussions, right? I mean, it's clearly understood everybody will have opportunity to talk about this in Seoul. There will be opportunity to come back and flesh out what we're talking about here in terms of perhaps changes TDRP or something new, whatever the case may be. It just keeps striking me that we keep seeing this moving on to the next stage, and in other working groups, it's usually when the group has reached some form of consensus that we use that expression moving on to the next issue. This is just a first round of discussions, correct?
I'm personally just moving on because I'm trying to keep an agenda as opposed to letting us go off into crazy tangents. So as far as I'm concerned, everything is, nothing has been decided, everything is still being discussed.
Excellent, perfect. Just wanted that for the record. Thanks, McKaylee.
I mean, just from my perspective, I'm involved with a couple of other working groups where the calls are excruciatingly painful because people go off in tangents for hours and nothing moves forward, and I think people die a little on the calls. So I prefer if we just at least make some effort to keep to whatever agenda we have. But I'm not saying that we shouldn't be discussing things again if needed, but I feel that we should be making some kind of tangible progress as opposed to just talking each other to death. Has anybody any other input on that at this time? No?
It's Olaf.
Hi, Olaf.
I just managed to raise my hand. Well, we did also, to rehash what was discussed to some extent, was that whether it would be a one-step process or two-step process if we had some that kind of return, and whether, if it was a two-step process, whether we kept it in its current state or returned it pending the final decision. So there were a few options we discussed which end up as some kind of matrix, if you like, just to rehash or refresh our memories about it.
Okay, thank you. Right, we'll have to come back to all this again anyway. Now, another item which was on the agenda for us to have a look at was to start having a look at Issue B. Issue B being whether additional provisions on undoing inappropriate transfers are needed, especially with regard to disputes between a registrant and admin contact. The policy is clear that the registrant can overrule the admin contact, but how this is implemented is currently at the discretion of the registrar. Now, has anybody got any thoughts on that topic? Olaf, I presume your hand is up from previously? Okay, wow, hands going up left, right and centre. James, go ahead.
Thanks, Michael. This is James speaking. And I guess I would like to get a better understanding of not going through all the different potential variations on how this is implemented, but when the concern is, and I think this is, if my memory serves, this question was raised from IRTPA. Does that sound familiar, Paul?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so I'm trying to remember the context of the differences of implementation and how that can harm the transfer process, and trying to think about what the potential outcome or how to clear that up would be, because it says right there in their charter that the policy already establishes the hierarchy between the admin contact and the registrant. So I just want to be sure I'm understanding exactly what it is we're setting out to solve by including this on our charter.
It is Paul's turn, but I suspect that Marika might be able to give us a little bit more insight into this, so I'm going to let her go first, if you don't mind. Marika,
yeah.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to point out that this is not only an issue that was raised by the IRTP Part A working group. They made a comment as well too, in the same direction, but it was already in the previous IRTP working groups that this was already identified as an issue. And I'm going to pull up the relevant sections from the issues report in a second, so people can have a quick look at some of the comments that were made in that respect. Actually, I think it was an issue that was raised as well by GoDaddy like a couple of years ago in relation to this issue. So if you give me a few seconds, I'll pull it up so people can refresh their memories.
Okay, thank you. Paul?
Right, I guess, thank you, Michele. Two things from IRTPA, as I recall, this question was focused, or the desire, and I hope I'm not putting words in Michael Collins' mouth, but his concern was really to focus on the precedence given to registrant over admin contact, less on the specifics of or the mechanisms that registrars are using. Because he used an example for domainers who are in some sort of business transaction with the domain. Often the admin contact is involved, and a registrant can come back after a transaction has been completed, claim that it wasn't done. In some cases, there's fraud associated with that or confusion, and he was pushing the A group, and that's where we are today, to make the recommendation that we look at whether the admin contact can have equal rights in authorizing a transfer. That was my recollection of A. It was not focused as much on the mechanics of when things are locked and who can remove a lock, etc. My other point, though, just for the record, is I wanted to, as we start this discussion, to underscore point that the registrar constituency made, and that I feel very strongly about, that the policy that's in place now is there for security reasons. Everybody remember the registrant contact information is not required information published in Whois. Therefore, it's usually out of the public domain and not susceptible to some form of social engineering or other fraud to initiate discussions or recommendations to allow the admin contact to have equal status and whatnot will introduce security concerns, something that this group needs to be ever vigilant about. If we agree to make any changes, that we always have to remember it's the classic trade-off between convenience and security, and any changes in the rules as they relate to registrant and admin contact will definitely have that sort of implication. And just really want to underscore at the beginning of the discussion that that's something we should not take lightly, and in all of our discussions always have that in the back of our mind.
So just one thing, Paul, sorry, just to clarify something. You're saying that the registrant and the admin, there's a difference in which is publicly available? What did you mean exactly?
although they often may be the same, the registrant contact information is not required to be published in the Whois. The admin contact is.
But it's going to be published in the Whois on the FIC registry.
Okay, I'm showing a bias because such an overwhelming majority of cases in dispute occur in common net.
Right.
So they are not in the thin registry models. But of course, we all recognize that the registrant is sort of the ultimate authority here. And at least in the thin registry models, if you were to change the rules, make admin equal status, or require publication of registrant contact, that will introduce security concerns that I was alluding to.
This is Tim McKaylee. I can't put my hand up in that.
That's quite okay, Tim. We'll allow you.
Oh,
go ahead.
I was just going to question, Paul, in regards to you said the registrant contact date isn't required to be published. Is it that I thought that it was? It was just that the email address is the part that's not published, which is what most registrars rely on in getting confirmation of transfers. So the reason the issue with the admin contact came up is because even if you should decide to want to go to the ultimate authority, the registrant, it's difficult to do because there's no way to get the information necessary to contact. So the registrant's published, and along with address and I think a few other elements that are required. But the ones that registrars typically contact them aren't available. Is that?
Yes, that's all correct, Tim. I'm sorry, I'm simplifying things too much. Right, it's the email and therefore the automated systems that registrars have to process transfer requests based upon email.
Got it. Okay, thanks.
I'm just looking just for, since GoDaddy's on the call and it's a perfectly good example, just to confirm, looking at the Whois output on GoDaddy.com, there's no email address visible in Whois on port 43 for the registrant, though there is for both the admin and the techie.
Yeah, I know, McKay, just to follow up on that, I know one of the issues, because when this was come up, and this has been discussed for a few years now, but I think one of the issues that came up was, you know, there was some suggestion about, well, why don't we just require the publication of the email address? Well, the problem is that we're not even required to collect it. So registrars, in some cases, might, but in other cases, they may not even have been collecting a registrant email address. And so the result is that, you know, we put a, I think, a pretty difficult burden. We didn't know how to deal with that issue of, you know, the retroactively trying to get email addresses for all registrants. Again, primarily with the, it's the ComNet or the thin registries that are the issue. So I don't know if that's reason enough not to visit that possibility, but I just want to throw that out there. That was one of the things that had been talked about.
Okay, thank you. James, you have your hand up.
Thanks, McKelly. This is James. And I think that Paul and Tim, through that exchange and with yourself, covered some of the things I wanted to raise. But I did want to point out that I think we were very careful in or whether it was IRTPA or council, but I want to say that the language of the charter is very careful in that it's discussing the implementation of how registrars disposition differences or an approval between registrant and administrative contact with regard to transfers, as opposed to changing that that dynamic. And I agree with Paul completely that we should reinforce or preserve the idea that the registrant can overrule the admin contact for all of the security concerns that he raised earlier. And I think that this could perhaps be a flavor or a component of the previous topic, which is the urgent return, because I think very simply if a registrant comes back later, then we would obviously need the urgent return mechanism to reflect that they've overruled the transfer. But other than that, I think most of the topics have been covered, but I just wanted to echo some of Paul's statements relative to the security, and that this, the way our charter reads is that we're talking mainly about implementation as opposed to changing that that pecking order.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else got anything else to say on this? No? Okay. We're actually doing pretty well time-wise. So has anybody got anything else they wish to raise at this time? Am I going to make ICANN history and have a conference call that actually finishes early?
This is Marika. We could also move on to issue 3.
Geez, Marika, don't be like that.
Unless people want to finish early, that's fine.
No, I'm only winding you up. Issue 3, which was what exactly?
It's whether special provisions are needed for a change of registrant when it occurs near the time of a change of registrar. Policy does not currently deal with a change of registrant, which often figures in hijacking cases. I'll post it as well in the
yes,
agenda.
Yes, they do. Well, if you just post it somewhere, we can view it. Okay, does anybody have any thoughts on that?
Is this the one, Chris speaking, is this the one that GoDaddy have implemented anyway themselves? Over.
James or Tim, would one of you like to respond to that?
This is Tim. I can comment on that. Yeah, we have implemented something like this. And I mean, it's evolved over time as we've tried to address concerns that were raised with it. I think, you know, initially we were trying to be as broad as we could with it, perhaps, with even concerns over the fact that, you know, the admin contact has transfer authority, so we had concerns there when that changes under certain circumstances. But at this point, basically, what we've done is if a domain name completely changes hands between registrants, in other words, you know, perhaps, for example, the domain name is sold on the aftermarket, and so it's completely being transferred to another registrant or owner, if you will, we will facilitate that change. We don't feel that it's something we're required to do, but we'll facilitate that change for free. We just notify the participants that if they proceed before the if they need to do a transfer, if they proceed before a transfer, then they agree to not transfer for 60 days for security reasons. If they need to transfer, then they should do the transfer first and then make the change at the new registrar. So that's basically the way we've kind of implemented it at this point. But the reason being that, in our experience, domain names that end up hijacked quite often start with some change in the registrant and also in the admin contact, but we don't apply that to this situation anymore. So I don't know if that helps clarify that or not. So I guess we have raised this issue just simply because of our experience and what we've seen in the past. And that, you know, I mean, we even seen that it was deemed reasonable under the previous discussions and under the current policy that a registrar may deny a transfer for 60 days after an inter-registrar transfer. So we're just proposing that it would deem reasonable that such a denial of transfer for some period of time after a registrant's transfer be considered as well.
Chris again. Can I ask, do you get many complaints, or what sort of percent, you know, I don't know if you got the figures off the top of your head, obviously, but a percentage of problems, in inverted commas, that are caused in genuine cases by that policy? Thanks.
We don't get, I don't know what it is. I know it isn't, it's by far not the majority of situations. We do get complaints. I can see if we can find out what percentage it is. But what normally happens is if someone does complain and we're able to do some separate confirmation or whatever, there are situations where we'll let the domain name go. Other situations where it isn't real clear and we can't get confirmation from both ends of the transfer, then we'll, you know, even though we may have a complaint, we'll leave it in place. And you know, we try to take those complaints even more seriously and do what we can to try to resolve them in situations where a pending renewal is coming up, because we know that concerns the new owner, that, you know, they're going to have to renew it with GoDaddy before they can transfer whatever. So we have that situation. So we do what we can to work with anyone who complains. But on the other hand, security is the main concern. So if we can't, you know, make some sort of determination or confirmation on both ends, both the old and new registrants, then we'll leave that 60-day lock in place.
Okay, Marika, and then James.
This is Marika, because I have a question, because in researching this issue, you know, I came across as well several registrants complaining about it, and they felt it was unnecessarily restrictive. But I thought at some point that I had read that GoDaddy had changed the policy, that instead of making that 60-day lock mandatory, it was, like, optional. So someone changing the WHOIS details could actually untick the box that would put on that lock. Am I understanding correctly that's not how it works anymore, or did it used to work
no longer?
Or?
No, it never worked that way. What we've tried to do is to, when someone wants to do a you know, that registrant-type transfer, is to make sure they know up front here's this optional service that you can use to do this, but part of the what you have to agree to, or part of the of our policy in regards to facilitating that change of registrant, is this 60-day lock. So the optional part is that they don't have to do it with us. They can transfer the name before they do it and change the registrant at a different registrar. But if they choose to use the service, change the registrant with GoDaddy, then they have to agree to that 60-day lock. So we tried to make that painfully clear up front so that no one's surprised later. That doesn't mean that even though they see it, that they don't later complain about it. But it's not. It's never been optional. The 60-day lock's not an optional thing, no.
Okay.
James, and then Eric.
Thanks, Michele. This is James. And I wanted to go back just to one previous topic to, I believe it was Chris's question about the complaints and what other types of alternatives can be used to get that. There's another side to that coin, Chris, which is how frequently this has saved a potential hijacking, and I can tell you that that is probably much more common than the types of issues that you were describing. So the scenario where while it's in this this GoDaddy 60-day lock, the original registrant comes up and says, "Hey, I think someone has compromised my my account, and I think that they're trying to move my domains somewhere else," and that we're able to help them resolve that issue because of this. So I think that that's a much more common outcome of this policy than the other side of that coin.
Eric?
Thanks. So this is two quick questions for Tim that maybe you can just help clarify from my own knowledge. At what point do you reject the transfer if there's been a registrant change or a registrant transfer? Is it before the transfer request is sent to the registry, or is it, you know, during the ACNAC period and you do some kind of check there and reject the transfer? And then the second question is, and maybe you said this but I might have missed it, what constitutes a registrant transfer? Is it any update to the record or just certain fields like the name field, or you know, if I change my telephone numbers that constitute a registrant transfer?
Right. The well, we can't deny a transfer before the request because the request starts at the gaining registrar, so we're not even aware that it's occurring until we get the notice from the registry that a transfer has been requested. So we would deny it at that point. When we receive the request, that domain name is flagged in our system, and so then that transfer request is rejected. We've had it various ways over the past, and we've tried to tighten it up to be more compliant with the current advisory and with concerns that have been raised by various parties and some of the complaints that we receive. So at this point, it's only if the actual registrant changes. So if a registrant moves and changes their address, that's a different thing. But if, for example, the actual name of the registrant completely changes, or the changes hands from registrant to a company, that situation would trigger that lock or a need to comply or to agree to that lock in order to complete that particular change. And it's related to the fact that there's nothing in our agreements that really provides for an assignment of a registration agreement. So we also have to go through the process of making sure that we have a registration agreement in place with the new registrant. And really none of that's actually covered in the RAA with registrars. So it's a part of our actual process to make sure we have a registration agreement in place with that new registrant. So it's actually just it's actually a new registrant.
Okay, thanks. Just one follow-up, and you clarified it very well there. I should have been more clear. I was curious if you put an EPP status on when the registrant changes and therefore block the transfer as opposed to actually NACing the transfer. But I think you did clarify it there. And your other points were very valid.
Anybody else have anything else to say on this? No? Okay. This call finishes at 4, is that correct, Marika? Or sorry, well, 3 or what? Sorry, I'm confused about time zones at this stage.
We don't have an official end time. I think we've said in the past that we would see where we will be at after an hour and see whether the group needed to go on for another 30 minutes.
Okay. No problem. Do we want to continue this on, or do we want to call this a day?
Just bring another item we would need to discuss is the next meeting after Seoul.
Okay. So we should pretty kind of look at wrapping this up then. Okay then. So the next meeting is when? Let's see, what sort of room am I going to?
If we would follow the normal schedule of biweekly meetings, the next meeting would be on the 10th of November.
Right, but we're having a meeting. We're having one meeting in Seoul on the 26th of October.
Yes, correct.
Fine, perfect. And then after that, I think Marika and myself were thrashing out possibilities for meetings after that, weren't we?
Yes, because one issue is that the ALAC has its monthly meeting on the 24th, and I think that is a conflict for some of the members of the working group. I don't think anyone on the call today. So one option would be to have a meeting on the 10th and the 17th to avoid the 24th, or another option would be to start on the 17th so we avoid the conflict. But it would mean that there will be 3 weeks of no activity.
Okay. Marika, maybe the best thing to do would just be to post that those options to the list. I mean, I've already given you my views on it. But if you want to post that out to the list so anybody else who has any particular preferences can give their input, and if there's no input from anybody, we'll remove democracy from the equation and just make a decision.
Well, maybe the question for those on the call, as you already said, your preference would there be any objections to having the meetings on the 10th and 17th and then return to the biweekly schedule?
Preferences, thoughts?
Can we take it up on the 10th?
Barbara agrees, I think.
Yes, that's correct.
So does Tim. And I think that was an agreement. Was that James? Kevin? Okay. I don't see anybody disagreeing. Well, there's more people agreeing. Everybody seems to agree. Okay, so that's... So for once we've agreed on something. Oh, my God. Wow. Right. Okay, we've reached consensus, and so that we'll move with that. Everybody's happy? So the next time we talk will be at some ungodly hour in the morning in Seoul. Is that correct, Marika?
That's correct. 7 o'clock in the morning.
Okay. I'll have to talk to you between now and then, Marika, to make sure that I actually make it there at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
How many of you will be there in person? We're on this call. Barbara won't, Paul won't, Tim Reith will be, James Bladell will be, Eric Brown will be, I will be, Kevin Erdman won't be.
Chris will be.
Chris, are you all going to be trying to get involved remotely on this? In the meeting?
Chris, yes.
Okay. Paul?
Not sure, Michele. I will try.
That's okay. Kevin and Barbara, are you going to be able to participate remotely, do you think?
I. It's not optimistic for me.
That's okay. Just checking.
Sorry.
Okay, then. So can we just call this a day, and I'll see you all in Seoul at some ungodly hour of the morning?
Sounds good. Thanks, Michele.
Okay, right. For some of you, I'll speak to you later. For the rest of you, see you in Seoul or somewhere. Thanks a lot. Thank you, Marika.
Thanks, Michele.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.